And thinking then of, you know, the sort of rape of how everybody saw the world with the introduction of industrialization, and the effect of that on art, if I suppose, to the extent that in the 20th century, you know, one begins to find artists operating outside of the traditional framework, moving into live activity, and then seeing that live activity, you know, in contrast and in relation to, you know, pre-industrial ritual, the one being the earlier historical stuff being inclusive of people, and the performances we were interested with in being alienating, signifying kind of alienation in one form or another. And this was the kind of premise that we started the film on. And there were sort of various aspects to it. For example, we wanted to contrast the historical material with contemporary, you know, the pre-industrial with industrial material. We thought that we wouldn't find anything pre-industrial in Britain that wasn't decayed and so forth, which was actually quite untrue. And we thought we were more likely to find it in Eastern Europe, where we knew that, for example, in parts of Romania, Bulgaria, there were strong traditions of rural, agricultural, strong agricultural processes going on, and that within that there was a strong ritualization to do with nature and so forth. So we thought of that, and then we thought of the relationship between contemporary performances, say in Eastern Europe as opposed to the Western Europe, or in coming out of societies that were socialistically based, and contrasting out societies that were capitalistic. And then we also thought of the possibility of activity which actually didn't have any of that kind of context, that was kind of stateless, thinking of individuals like Metzger. And also we thought of the Viennese group of involved with direct art in the 60s, people like Bruce, who were forced to leave Austria, you know, because of their activities, because of the police, they're breaking the law and so on, and moving, and so we were interested in that aspect, and that's the only part that we haven't really taken up. It doesn't really seem to be particularly relevant. I mean, it seemed like a very good idea at the time. So this was a sort of broad framework for, you know, the film. Well, once we started looking with the camera, well, we made another, I think, quite significant decision. We decided to use a news camera, CP16, and we decided to use positive film as opposed to negative film, which means that you can film in much darker situations. You know, it's essentially the camera is essentially a machine that can be used in very, very flexibly. Whereas if one's relying on other kinds of cameras, you know, one you have to deal with lighting and so on and so forth in another kind of way. So we were treating, right from the very beginning, some of these activities as being news active. We're treating them as the news because if one's going, for example, to Haxey in Lincolnshire to film the Haxey Hood being an annual ritual which takes place, I think, on the 6th of January in the middle of a field, up to 300 people. There's no way that you can ask them to, would they mind, you know, doing this or that. They're doing it. And if you get in the way, so much the worse for you. There's no way you can actually control the lighting. You've got to deal with it as news. You know, like, it's like filming a battle.
You can't stage manage it.
No way can you do it. So what the film we've got is very interesting from that point of view, precisely because we've treated it as news. And also we had a team that were actually experienced in news coverage. So that's one sort of basis on which we approach the film as news. And part of the film, I mean, is very much to do with how one films performance and how one films ritual and so forth. And from that point, from establishing the notion of news, that is, or filming where one had no control and one had to sort of, in a way, grasp the opportunity or die or not get anything, we then devised, not in any preconceived way, but as we got into the making of the film, different strategies with different sorts of performances in different contexts. For example, we were able to it was a question of what degree of negotiation we could achieve with each phenomenon we wanted to film, as to what the actual film would, you know, the resulting material would look like, and therefore how we could treat it in relation to the film. We thought of, for example, there may well be activities that we that would be totally unsuitable to film, but might be very suitable in terms of somebody remembering, talking, using language about what they'd seen. You know, we've got one or two like that. We've got some where the camera is on the outside the work as it takes place, and we've got some where the camera is actually invited into the workspace, as it were, of the activity. We've got some where the performance is actually broken down or deconstructed and then recreated for the camera, not recreated in a form that it might have been made before, for example, but created in relation to the needs of the camera in terms of thinking, well, what would a film be like if one was going to take this particular event, say, and then relate it to a filmic process, you know, rather than just document it? How would one deconstruct it and then create something which is not just a documentary out of it? So we've begun to approach the film from all these points of view. We recognised fairly quickly, we probably had thought of it before, that you know, there's really no such thing as truth in all of this, and that it's quite feasible that we would have to manipulate the material in order to construct something that we thought was closer to the truth than, say, just sticking a camera in front of something. You know, we had to, or for example, strengthening the emotional strength or the emotional character of something by stretching, by freeze framing, by stretching, by cutting in certain ways. So all of the traditional filmic processes and some processes which come from systemic, what do you call it, the systems approach to film, I can't think of the word all of a sudden.
Structuralist
filmmaking and so forth. We've tended to incorporate, you know, certain mechanisms that we've seen used by other filmmakers in order to try to amplify, you know, a particular activity. So that this is by no means, this film can by no means be called a documentary in the sort of conventional sense of the word. But I think that if it when we finally get it together, it will have a certain kind of strength to it, precisely because we've actually approached it in the manner that we're attempting.
Were you consciously drawing parallels between what you describe as pre-industrial ritualistic activities and acts that may take place in a field in a part of rural part of England, and, you know, live work as you may have been involved in?
Yes, there was a definite view about that. I mean, what we were, and one could sort of, it's a question of how the film is finally established as to what the meaning of that is going to be. Our intention behind it is, one, not to try to force a unit, a relationship, which would be quite superficial. Secondly, not to suggest any sense of nostalgia about lost, the good old days, or however one wants to describe it. But much more to say that in to say that in certain circumstances, you know, certain activities tend to take place which are more than rational. Certainly the rituals that we have, I don't know whether one should even call them rituals, whatever they are, well, for want of a better word, rituals. The English rituals that we've seen, which is the Padstow horse, it's difficult for me to call it, it's os, the Padstow os, the Haxey Hood, and the Castleton, I can't remember the name of the Castleton, three we've filmed. One can certainly, this is not so true with Castleton, because it comes into a different category than the other two, and the other two are actually different from each other. So they are three rather different contexts. But one of the things that exists in all of them is a sense of oneness. This is most clearly demonstrated in Haxey, where you know that one can almost say that there is no audience, that you know whoever is there is part of it. Some people obviously stand and stop and look, and some people go into the activity and come out again. But there's no specified audience. In Padstow, there are two teams of people who engage in certain activity, and around them there are outer rings of activity like bands and dancers. But beyond that, the public, as it were, whoever they are actively involved in it. They may be dancing, they may be not, they may be drinking, they may be singing the songs, but the division between the participants and the audience, let's say, is quite unclear. Mm-hmm. And also there's a very strong sense of togetherness, to the extent that cameras are not very much appreciated in Padstow at that time, because this particular event is still very strong enough for them to say, you know, like, we really don't want what is represented by cameras, you know, interfering with this, which one has to respect. And the third kind of activity would be the ones we saw in Castleton, where there is a sort of division, but it's a division much more like the way one would get a carnival with people looking at it, you know. In public, as it were.
Yeah.
Now, all of those have the in one way or another, or to a greater or lesser extent, a sense of being of an inclusive sense of people being included in the general activity. Now, that's what I had thought would be found what I called, you know, for want of a better term, pre-industrial rituals, because I had conceived of a ritual which may take place, say, to do with spring, like in Padstow, where the say a pre-Christian ritual, where there would be a celebration of nature or the changing of the seasons, sort of sublimated, as it were, into, you know, like there being some sort of deity of some kind, you know, maybe an idol of some sort. Where people actually celebrated something that actually happened, but they couldn't rationalize. You know, it was a non-rationalized kind of rationalization, if you like. It was a way of actually being able to deal with it, and it was inclusive, and it's quite peculiar to us. Now, if one contrasts that, and this is the point. In highly industrialized society, one's more conscious of division than anything else, and divisions of all kinds in so many different ways, to the extent that culture itself is, you know, becomes one of any number of commodities, etc., etc. And therefore, from my point of view, the live activity within a higher cultural dimension was actually to do with attempting to slip outside of the commodity type structure, and therefore the easy consumerist condition into a into a into a into an arena where there could be some sort of communication. But when that happens, what occurs is a thoroughly alienated. It is a form of alienation. The very notion of art, it seems to me, has an aspect of alienation about it, whether it be in the, but also was signifying in its imagery, if you like, in what it and in its process, alienation, which is what one of the main conditions of the society. One, you know, so that in fact, what one's really saying, to make it all very much over simple, in sort of rural societies, one tended to get a notion of inclusiveness, even though one might have had simple class divisions, you know, and so forth. And in the highly developed industrial society, certainly within the dimension of high culture, which is, you know, like where live work is taking place to a large extent, one has this tremendous alienation. And it may well be that the attempt by the artist is in fact to overcome that alienation. And it's very ironic that the very attempt actually reinforces the circumstances of it. So the film is actually working with this particular argument. It's not really saying that the one comes out of the other or etc., but that, you know, society throws up certain sorts of social behaviour to do with the unknown, you know, which we can call cultural, if you like, and that they do refer to each other in certain ways, and they contrast with each other. If one then takes that further and in a more limited way and says, well, what actually happens, shall we say, in Eastern Europe, and one has to recognise that each country has a different social emphasis, not just in terms of the particular character of socialism, but, you know, the actual society itself and its history and so on. What would be the argument for, or a range of arguments for, live activity, performance, let's say, for example, in Czechoslovakia, as in England? What would be the similarities? What makes performance actually occur in a place like Hungary? What kind of arguments are given to it? What are the contrasts? What are the similarities there as well? And that's another part of the issue, you know. And so that one is saying all the time in suggesting that there are in the material condition, the material conditions produce, to some extent, the particular kind and character of activity.
Of the art.
Yeah, of the art.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if one says, well, why live work in relation to ritual when ritual takes place outside of the, you know, the sort of hierarchy of higher art, it's probably because one of the reasons for performance is the attempt to escape from the high cultural context into a broader context, which offers the possibility of actually posing them and seeing, you know, what differences and similarities there might be.
I suppose it is this business of a society, pre-industrial society, being able to share in a rather complex way, maybe, an innate feeling innate feeling about
That's
something,
right.
And you know, the idea of the participation stroke observation involvement of the ritual in the field, you know, they're neither, you know, the audience isn't an audience, it's somehow involved, they're doing all sorts of things, like drinking, but somehow they're still involved because they're sharing something. And
yes, and they haven't been, they see, the most interesting thing about that is that they haven't been subject to a form of division or categorization. If one looks at the Haxey Hood, for example, one could, it's obviously, well, you could see it from all kinds of points of view, but certainly you could see it as a kind of primitive kind of football or rugby. It certainly has that aspect to it. There is a shape, a form in the middle, you know, which people are fighting over, and there are two goals, as it were, one in one direction and one in the other, albeit so many miles apart. But it is there. But that's about it as far as anything else is concerned. And if one sort of thinks of that in relation to, let's say, contemporary football, professional football, where, you know, everything is so divided and ordered and so forth, and you get certain kinds of ritualization of response and reaction and so forth, which when it actually breaks out of its categorization, becomes hooliganism, vandalism, etc., etc. You know, it's as soon as it actually begins to break those categories, it becomes an antisocial act. Whereas if you look at the Haxie Hood, it has all of those features of being antisocial, in the sense that it's like an anarchic force.
But it incorporates them.
Yes, yes, and it moves where it will. I mean, even though the police are there and the ambulances and everything else, you know, it's a force that no one individual can deal with. No, because there are so many people, and it is an homogenous group with two aims in mind, with one single purpose: to get that from there or to there, from either left or right, going through fields, going along roads. And it's a bit like it also has all kinds of obviously historical references, which I don't know much about, you know, where one sees it in, for example, in southwest Germany and the Black Forest and Narrenfest, where the pre-Lenten festivals and so on, where the accepted social patterns are released, as it were, for a short time.
Yeah.
Other activities occur which are essentially anarchic in a way, and I find that very interesting in relation to, you know, the kind of social problem that occurs with, say, something like football, which is on the one hand being all the time promoted as being, you know, the national sport, etc., 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 promoted in terms of businesses and so on, exploiting the interests of children for commerce and so on, all the time drawing people towards it, and then, you know, having to deal with the response, you know, that occurs in a very authoritarian and repressive kind of way. There are dangers, of course, in sort of filming things like the Haxie Hood, in the sense that, I mean, I doubt whether this is going to happen, because it would depend on the film becoming, sort of exposed over very wide areas, and I don't think it will be. It would be unlikely if it was. But it would be a great shame if, in fact, something like the Haxie Hood was celebrated to the extent that people wanted to go to such an extent that they would change its nature. I mean, it's actually best left doing what it's doing with the power that it's got, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
sure. And that's very true. That's also very true with the what's going on down in Cornwall, and all the others that are going on. I mean, the key to it is that these things are actually live and powerful, and serious, very serious. I think
they're not tourist attractions.
Not at all. I think they're very serious. I mean, I think they're very important too. I think they're very important to the area, as it were, to the people. There may be much more important than the in one sense than shall we say Christian ritual, you know, like Christmas, for example.
And they haven't been reappropriated either by any vested interest.
No,
they seem to have stayed way they were.
Yeah,
perhaps
yeah.
Nothing to exploit.
No, and maybe they have changed, but they've still got their power. Yeah. It doesn't mean to say that because they're changed, their power is going to be reduced, but they've adapted to the circumstances in which they take place.
Which is correct as well.
Yeah, yeah, and I that was a big surprise to us, very naive surprise. I think we were very naive about the approach to this. We automatically assumed that, you know, that those things would be decayed. That's in a way a kind of shows the sort of confidence one has in living in Britain. One's so sure that everything is decayed. Working, you know, moving away from making objects into involving human behaviour and one's own behaviour as a something that can be related to, you know, in relation to some idea that may be carried through it and some feeling and so on. That the context, the historical context that are given for that tend, at least in Britain, and I'm sure this is true, tend to be within the terms of art, the way art history is constructed, tend to be American. There is that emphasis because of the sort of cultural, the sort of imperialism that, you know, we experience from the States, you know, the work is tended to be seen within an art historical context which has a very high quotient of American experience built into it. And I actually reject all that, I reject it to a large extent, probably because I lived in the States long enough to feel thoroughly un-American. It was probably the last thing that I expected to feel when I went, because I wanted to get away from here. You know, anything to get away from here was a good thing, and that seemed to be a very good place to go. But what I discovered was the sense of how un-American I was, and hence how much I was what I was, you know, which was, I suppose, how European I felt, or how much more sympathetic I felt with Europeans and so forth. And therefore, all the time there's been a kind of desire, an inarticulate desire, to find sources which one, aren't the result of that sort of imperialism coming from either America or more recently Germany. Or if one was in Eastern Europe, would be Russia, I presume. But much more, you know, like where is the source? And also sources which aren't located up in the you know, the high cultural area as well, because you know, that seems to me to be a sort of somewhat of a hothouse, you know, and a sort of force. Cultivation, you know, sort of hothouse cultivation, quick growing blooms and all that stuff. So looking for some other kind of relation with other dimensions, it has also within it a political aspect of looking for antecedents which are based in the experience of the root of the question, rather than in this other. I find, for example, I'm really fascinated by Thomas Hardy, and coming from a sort of rural background myself, and then thinking, well, there's got to be a relationship between, you know, the area that I come out of, and what I'm thinking of, you know, even if I'm living in a town and all the rest of it. So searching for some kind of connection, I think there is a strong sort of attraction in that for me. And this is now getting sort of somewhat autobiographical, but the fact that, you know, growing up in one place and then moving a lot, you know, different countries for different periods of time, all either in the country or in the city, but mostly in big cities, which is like developing a kind of currency, an art currency. You know, yeah, I lived in Berlin, New York. You know that sort of, yeah. That kind of attraction that is half conscious, and you do, you know, that sort of. Well, I, which is actually a way of disassociating. Becoming disassociated from any kind of base, because of the aspiration of, you know, like moving in other dimensions, like the, you know, like sort of professional art practice and all that, finally sort of getting old enough, you know, to find it hard going to to keep going moving, you know, from one place to another. And beginning to think much more about, you know, where I am, where I'm living at the moment. That was reinforced by doing the Peter Lee project. It's definitely reinforced by dealing with the whole issue of history within living memory, with the mining community. While I was doing that, feeling, you know, like I'd like to do this with me, as well as, you know, always be doing it with other people, the more one does it with other people, the more one feels has a sense of anonymity somehow.
I suppose we've all been sort of hooked up into this internationalism.
Yeah. It came at a point with me, 1956, when I think the first time I saw America's at the Tate, very powerful show of Pollock, and I remember de Kooning and I think Klein and that lot. Extraordinarily powerful and really disturbing, because the terms of reference, you know, as to what was or wasn't a good painting or not, was so totally different and alien, and yet tremendous energy seeming to come out of it all, you know, like a sort of very disturbing exhibition for somebody who's a student. And that sort of being reinforced by further injections, you know, coming from the States to the extent of that influencing me, for example, and I know several other people to such an extent, I went and lived there for 4 years, 4.5 years. But I'm really glad I did that, because if I hadn't have done that, I think I might have gone on living the sort of, you know, a myth about it all. It's to do with not wanting, not desiring to go somewhere else, you know, if the opportunity arises. I mean, one can create those opportunities now, maybe, to some extent, and not really wanting to, because here, where one is more interesting. Although on the face of it, it appears to be sort of relatively uninteresting. If you look at the art world, highly uninteresting art world, on the surface, you know. Sure. I mean, but underneath, it's extremely interesting, it seems to me. There is that desire to, you know, to sort of like relate to but not to relate to something that has been predetermined for one to relate to, you know. For whatever interest, on the behalf of certain interests, like, you know, let's say, ultimately, you know, business, for example. I mean, if we there must be a correlation. Oh God, we're getting into must be a correlation between art history and the business. What I mean by the business is, in fact, the market and exchange of artworks, and the development of art history, you know, contemporary art history, and there must be a relationship between the two. In other words, you need to have good vibrations, you know, surrounding products in order for them to become viable, you know, to become really desirable, etc. They have to have their own antecedents, their own history, etc., etc. And hence, you know, you have to there has to be a history that actually provides that in some way or other, you know. It may not be the art history that's taught in a school, but it's bound to be there in one form or another. And therefore, you know, if one is actually not interested in that at all, I have no connections with any commercial. I have had shown in commercial gallery, but I have no commercial connections. You know, there's got to be another source of, you know, so one goes to where one feels that it is, you know, which is actually to the ground, if you like. Where the hell is the ground? You know?
Yeah.
And what is it? And where, and is there a history, you know, that I could construct for myself, which is more relevant for me, you know, or that I could construct around certain issues which might be relevant for more than me, maybe two or three other people, let's say, you know, some other few people might actually relate to that as well. But no one's saying that it's going to be universal by any means, but it's actually a refusal to, or an attempt to get away from that kind of overview, which is so conformist, you know, and related to, you know, like the predominant thing of the society, you know, the whole sort of turnover of commodities.
Where art becomes a commodity and is consumed. And
right, and I really do stick on that. I mean, it's probably very stupid to do so, but I actually can't do it. I actually stick on it, absolutely. I can't even want to jump the divide. And the unfortunate thing is that if one takes that position, then one takes on what appears what is obviously a moral position in some ways, a political position. And by implication, it looks as though one is actually then making judgments about other artists, which I don't like thinking about. I much prefer to think that the system is such that, you know, most artists, in order to do what they want to do, you know, are going to find some connection in that direction, if you see what I mean. Mm. You know. Mm. I don't think that it's the artists who make the problem at all. I think they are the ones who actually are being, shall we say, realistic. There is a degree of concreteness about that in relation to them. But I think it's an extremely negative one, quite frankly. Mm. So it's actually that one's views on that are really much more, my views on that are much more to do with my partial understanding of the broader circumstances in which, you know, these things occur, rather than being directed against specific individuals. You know, there's that old sort of chestnut, you know, like, is painting dead? Yes, a lot of people say painting is dead and all of that, but it seems to me that the real problem is painting being suffocated by consumerism, or, you know, is it actually being killed by being forced to play the role, you know, play a specific role in the exchange of commodities, you know, to such an extent. And I think it's far more likely that it suffers from that than one can say, well, it's a redundant activity, which I don't think it is.
No.
I think it's merely suffering from the particular sorts of restrictive containing notions, you know, as to what the social practice around it can be. You know, and we don't even begin to think of alternative. Well, we do obviously, but in public, it would appear that alternatives can't be thought about, or aren't thought about.